Hi everyone, my name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. We could really use the help. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Before we get started here, though, I want to tell you about our new monthly guidebook / workbook called The Motivated Musician. It's geared towards serious musicians, and it offers challenges, exercises, professional advice, and more to help keep your career and your musical life on track. Also, as an extra perk, members get exclusive discounts from MyMusicMasterclass.com. So if you want to learn more, go to MyMusicMasterclass.com and you'll see the subscribe link in the menu. Click that and you'll be good to go. All right, everyone. So we are fortunate enough to be joined by a very, very cool guy and a super talented musician, Larry Kuntz. And if you don't know him, you know, he's a great, great guitarist. He's played with all kinds of people, and he's one of my favorite musicians. He's played with, I don't know, I mean, should we even do this? Like John Patitucci, Luciano Sosa, Natalie Cole, Bob Mincer. He just did a gig with Bob Shepard and Marvin Smitty Smith down in Vegas, right? That must have been refreshing, right?
Oh, man, it felt so good to play again.
So you're still alive.
Normal. Who would have thought you'd feel normal in Vegas?
Exactly.
So what's up, man? How have you been, you know, before this and, you know, during this whole quarantine period?
Yeah, it's been pretty strange, although interestingly enough, I'm embracing not playing right now. I'm seeing a lot of ego issues in my playing. Sometimes you have some distance from things and you see your motivation for doing certain things a little more clearly. And I can see how much of myself when I'm actually performing for an audience has to do with trying to get a reaction. So for me, it's been really healthy. I mean, I'm really kind of, and I'm enjoying practicing. There's a real purity, I think, that's emerging out of this that maybe wasn't there to the same extent before the lockdown. I'm also just enjoying sort of being away from the constant nature of playing day in and day out, being a professional musician that has existed since I was 16. So it's nice to get away from that frenetic energy, you know?
How do you practice, like, getting out of that habit of trying to play what you think people want to hear? Like, because you want to hear that too, no? That's part of, you're part of the audience. Like, how do you work on that?
Well, that's interesting. I don't think you can work on it. It's like, you know, it's like when you're meditating, don't think of apple pie. Right. You know?
So you're on, it's like unwork?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a state of being, you know, and but there is a place of something emanating from the outside that rings true, you know, that really addresses the moment that can come out and you recognize it, you know? And so it's just basically, for me, it's just a matter of recognizing what that is. Interestingly enough, when we were first on lockdown, I put my instrument away and dealt with a lot of household issues, household improvements, organizing files, digitizing things because I was getting ready for the next school year, which is going to be exclusively taught, via Zoom. Yeah. And so I didn't play for 3 weeks, and I came back to playing guitar, and I swear it was so easy. It was better than when I practiced all the time. The channels were just open. It felt so good to do it.
I've definitely felt that before. I mean, I've had to tech out on tour as legit, just a technician, just out no instrument in my hand for like 6 months. And I remember coming back and it was like swimming for the first time in like five. Like, you're like, oh my God, the water feels amazing. You know what I mean? It's a crazy right. feeling.
And you were on the road with, yeah. with Pat. So that just hurt your brain.
Yeah. That was another thing too. He made everything look so easy. So I also thought I could just do what he was doing. And I was like, all right, well, that's not going to happen. But
yeah.
So, I mean, you always have a very relaxed nature while you're playing and, you know, do you meditate? Do you just have a good, predisposition to chilling? Do you do anything do you drink heavily?
That's a good millennial word, chilling. Good, Adam.
Millennial?
Is that millennial?
I don't know. I feel like it's Generation X, maybe.
I'm a generation older than you. I don't think we use chilling, but we won't get into this right now. What was the question again?
You're not that old, right? You already, yeah.
Okay. I am. I'm getting there.
No, so do you do anything actively to stay calm, meditation or breathing or yoga or stretching or anything?
You know, that's such a great question, Adam. And I actually, it's taken me years. I do, for the most part, I am pretty relaxed when I play. I'm not so worried about perceptions of other people, perceptions of other musicians. When I have a bad day, I accept it. So I've kind of come to peace with a lot of the demons that plague a lot of musicians, especially in the earlier years. But that being said, my earlier years were hell. I mean, through my 20s, I was so self-critical that sometimes I was thinking, I can't do this anymore. I mean, it was so painful to go through that process of over and over again of sort of tearing myself apart. If you stick with it long enough, and what I see now in the rearview mirror is that a lot of that stuff is stuff that our busy monkey brains invent.
Right.
A lot of that stuff starts to go by the wayside. You start to focus more on the music, and you start to not give too much importance to, my problem was this horrible concept that everything had to be perfect. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wouldn't make a move because it would be always be less than perfect. And I'd feel at some point, you know, sort of frozen or unable to sort of have some forward momentum because that was constantly with me. And then there's also the perception that you're worried about what other people are thinking about your performance, either the audience or the musicians you're playing with. So that was, you know, those were huge stumbling blocks. But I think if you do it enough, it starts to lose its weight.
So it just naturally lost its weight for you? Because I know, for instance, that many, many musicians deal with that exact same thing. I mean, you know, the fact that they're striving for perfection, you'll never hit it, right? And I mean, no one hits it. And the people that are on the top of the world in your eyes or in our eyes often think that they just sound like shit. You know what I mean? You know how it works. The more the better you get, the more self-deprecating you become many
it's
times.
True.
And, but yeah, you've just found a way to kind of drop it.
Well, early on, I mean, I went through, you know, drugs and alcohol, meditation, yoga, you know.
All at the same time?
He's like, and then Thursday.
It was a really fast growth period for me.
I saw that on Netflix. That documentary was really good.
No, I mean, there's long periods of like, you know, here's the interesting thing. Self-criticism, I think, is a good thing to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. It's when it veers into the avenue of self-hatred, that's when it's bad.
Right.
When you start gauging your self-worth based on your perceptions of a performance or your perception of where you are in the music world or the fact that you read Downbeat and your name hasn't been mentioned
right.
for the last, you know, 16 issues.
Yeah, you can't care about that.
You can't care about that shit. It's all bullshit. No, it's all external stuff that has nothing to do with music.
You're on the upbeat anyway, so don't, you know. Fuck the downbeat. That's for suckers.
But You know, it's funny what you were talking about. Have you ever seen that YouTube video on negativity bias by Rick Hansen? He's this neuropsychologist. It's a TED Talk, and it's 13 or 14 minutes. It's really cool. And I know about it because I just talked about it in the latest issue of our guidebook, which is called The Motivated Musician. And this thing's really cool because Dr. Hansen talks about how all that negativity that we have in our minds is pre-programmed from being cavemen. We're hardwired to remember the negative stuff and not the positive stuff because it kept us alive. Therefore, if you were being chased by a tiger, it's like you have to remember that because you want to remember where that tiger was, or, you know, and you don't really remember the good stuff. So he said that's why when you're doing your dailies and you have like five great things happen and then one bad thing, when you're going to sleep at night, you're dwelling on the one bad thing. And so he kind of goes through how to stop that thinking. And it's very interesting. But he said it's totally hardwired in humans because of fight or flight. It's old. It's really cool.
Adam, I love this. This is fascinating to me. And what's the name of the TED Talk again?
It's it's Dr. Rick Hansen. It's about negativity bias, which is a psychological term. You can find it'll come up if you Google that. But it might be called hardwiring happiness or something. But it's okay. Super cool, man. I mean, it's just interesting and it makes a hell of a lot of sense. You know,
I love it. This is right down my alley.
Totally.
You know what I've always struggled with? And I like to ask these questions when you guys are around. The plateau of music, when you just learn how to get really good at something, you know what I mean? And then you break through and realize, like, you just started, you know what I mean? Like, that plateau, especially with something like a language like jazz, like, I think that stops a lot of musicians in their tracks. So when you were saying, like, in your 20s, you know, it was like a nightmare for you, I feel like that's maybe where you were. You were in that gray area of like, you have to work so much harder to now like get to the level of the stuff that you want to learn. But is that, I feel like that's kind of common, right? That gray area. How do you like get through that? You just have to blow through it, right?
Totally. Jake, it's a great observation because, you know, those plateaus are usually the harbingers of something that's going to be, you know, pointing to some serious growth, yeah. Except when you're in that plateau, it can be totally miserable, you know? And there might be little micro, you know, little bits of micro growth here and there, you know, little insights, but it's nothing major. And then, you know, for me, the process has always been when I'm in that plateau, if I in the past would focus too much on being sort of in this stasis. Is that a word?
Yeah, that makes
sense.
In the
middle ground stasis, yeah. Not moving anywhere. If I focused too much energy on it, I would find that I would stay in that zone a lot more.
Yep.
If I remove myself from that frame of mind and just sort of work on something creative or stop practicing and sort of take a walk or watch a movie or, you know, or just work on some music that's sort of on my plate from an artist that I'm working with. Often when I take my focus and move it on to something that has nothing to do with myself, that's when I make that leap past that plateau and find some space that I didn't find before.
Yeah, kind of like hitching a ride instead of just putting it all on yourself. You kind of just jump on something else and it'll get you there eventually.
And I think the lesson for me down the road is that there's so many self-sabotaging mechanisms. The biggest lesson is, you know, if you can get yourself out of the way and find strategies to do that, then you're going to be a lot more mentally healthy.
Yeah, and I think that's why what you were saying, like when you're away from your instrument for a while, you said the channels were open. And that's because you're not obsessing over it. Like you actually expect to be awful when you pick up the guitar. You're like, oh man, I'm going to be super rusty. So you're not even, you have the guitar. It's like you first learned and then it just goes right through you. So that definitely, that makes sense. You just shut yourself off of that bad shit.
That's right.
All right. So I actually have a question that a listener messaged in to the site and I think that you'd be perfect for it actually. So I'm going to read this to you. He says, I'm mostly a self-managed musician. I take lessons here or there, but don't have any specific teacher. Sometimes I get myself into a corner with working on something where I'm making slow and steady progress. I might be able to get things playable to sort of a level of proficiency, but I'm just holding it together. It might be that it's difficult enough that it would take me years of work to get it to a professional polish and that I'm better off dropping it and maybe coming back to it or maybe not coming back to it. It happens somewhat less as I start to know my own abilities and I'm gaining more proficiency, but it's still a fundamental issue. So, this listener wants us to talk about that place where you're working on something and maybe you decide to drop it and come back to it, or alternatively, you decide to dig in and nail it.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's such a multifaceted question. And I think it's sort of at the crux of a lot of players that are sort of at that point where they're intermediate musicians. They know a lot. They've worked for a long time to accomplish something. Yet they don't feel like they have this, the kind of ease maybe that people that they look up to sort of exhibit. And that kind of flow. Flow is a good word. So I totally relate to so many issues that were brought up in that question. And I do remember a time in my life, this is in my mid-20s, where I had a bit of a crisis. And I really had to stop playing. Some of the issues that we talked about, you know, it's always multi-layered. So one of those issues was inconsistency of technique, but another issue was the kind of stifling self-criticism and self-hatred that just made me, you know, miserable.
Did you lose faith in the techniques as well?
Well, that's a good question. Actually, what it led me to was to redefine what technique is.
Nice.
So when I went through this crisis, I put down the guitar for 2 months. We already talked about how getting away from something can sort of clear out the cobwebs, can also clear the channels, because they're, you know, these are invisible things that we're talking about. We're talking about the nervous system.
Yeah.
You know, so the nervous system, when you are self-critical, your muscles are reacting to that kind of self-criticism. You're getting tight. Some people get tendonitis because they overpractice, or they're overly tense, or, you know, and this is all caused by thoughts. That's the source of all this stuff. So it's very difficult to get a handle on this. So at that time that I was sort of struggling with, I'll call them demons. They feel like demons. They feel like you don't have a handle on any of the stuff that's sort of entering into your life at those moments that sort of cause you to sort of derail yourself. When I came back to playing, I remember there was a specific day where I saw my guitar on the stand. I hadn't played for 2 months. And I walked up to the guitar and I wanted to play it. It was a genuine feeling that I wanted to come and feel the guitar in my hands. And I remember playing an F major scale for maybe 5 minutes, out of time, no metronome marking. And it was the most satisfying experience I'd had playing guitar since when I was at the age of 7, when I started playing, when I had no ability. I was not a prodigy. I enjoyed it, though. I always enjoyed it. But it was satisfying to that same extent. And so what followed was a redefinition of what technique was. So I went to USC, pretty intense program, great, great music program. And I had like, you know, 4 hours at least. I wasn't a 10-hour-a-day practicer or a 6-hour-a-day practicer. But I went through a phase where it was 4 hours consistently. And I had, in that 4-hour space, I had a really well-defined set of steps that I had to move through, always with a goal in mind. So, you know, technical exercise played at this much metronomic marking. Transcriptions, learning, you know, bits of melodic vocabulary, increasing the chord vocabulary, looking into solo repertoire. And it started to really feel like tasks. It was not enjoyable for me. So when I played that F major scale, the shocking thing was that's the first time I'd really enjoyed playing since maybe junior high. you know, when I was really kind of not serious about it. When I started to get serious, that's when I started to not enjoy it. You know, when I decided that this is going to be my career, there was an external pressure and an internal pressure to really, you know, get my shit together.
Because you wanted to be a full-time musician.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, I realized, you know, by the time I was in high school, I was actually, you know, in my age group, I was, you know, I would say, you know, better than most. Nothing, you know, no Julian Lodge here. You know, Julian was,
he's,
you know,
freaky good.
Doing backflips, you know, when he was seven.
I know. He played Coltrane on a, he played Countdown on a kazoo in his crib.
When I came back to practicing, and it had sort of this, I hate to use this word, it sounds like an oversimplification, but joy at its center. Yeah. And the joy was just, you know, feeling the fingernail against the string or the pick against the string, feeling the flesh against, you know, in the left hand as it pressed down the string. There's something very satisfying about that. Playing slowly, playing with a good sound. Sound is very important for me now. Sound is sort of my centering thing. If my sound is good, technically, almost everything follows, you know. Honestly, with very little effort, sound is a big thing, though. So a lot of slow practice, and that built, I built on that. So, you know, I practice about an hour to 2 hours a day, and it's very satisfying. I work with repertoire. I don't work above my means. I always work so that it's musical. So when it's musical, the mechanics disappear. You know, if I was a blues musician, if I was Albert King, you know, and you were interviewing me about the mechanics of blues playing,
yeah,
how many really good strategies do you think I would give you? You know, they learn by, first of all, imitating voice.
I think you'd have some really wise words, but you'd have to read between the lines. You know, that's what you have to do with the masters like that, you know. It's all about
that's
feel
right.
for him.
It was never about mechanical approaches. It was about, you know, how am I going to get this to sound like a human voice?
Yeah.
You know,
he didn't say, like, I'm going to overbend this by just this much to get a little bite on it. You know, he wasn't. Yeah.
Right. It's not mathematical. You can't say, oh, I bend this string, you know, a quarter of an inch always. And no, it's going to be different every time. There's no quarter of an inch or inch, you know, it varies from time to time. Sometimes it's sharper bend. Sometimes it's a flatter bend. You know, sometimes it's, you know, a miscalculation, and that's okay too.
Along these lines, because I know that this user, from what he's told me in his emails, is he got burnt out earlier. He went to NEC when he was in his, you know, 18, 19, 20 or whatever, and got burnt out as a jazz bassist and basically went into a whole different career as a nurse. And now at 45, he came back and just decided he really enjoys playing guitar. And so he's picking it up like that. So I know he has the love for it. I think he's just hitting his head against a wall and getting frustrated with certain things. Like, so can you use what you're saying to help that situation as well by just like taking a step back, or is that, would you use that same technique about when you find a piece that's challenging for you?
Absolutely. First of all, you will not be consistent technically if you're playing above your means. You will never be consistent. So you always have to back it up.
I
if
see.
There's something that you can't pull off technically. So now it's about reframing how you look at that, how you look at technique. And like you said, he's sort of really enjoying the process. He's curious again. It's difficult to diagnose these things without being in the same space with the person. But the fact is that once it starts to feel like what we were talking about, the great blues masters feel, which is that they're singing through the instrument. It actually feels, I hate to be abstract, I have to a little bit. It feels like it's coming from your gut. It feels like almost like you're taking a breath and you're singing through the instrument. When I feel centered and aligned and I feel this degree of ease. So now reframing has to do with, you know, there's so much in education that has to do with time in terms of like placement, exact placement. There is no exact placement. Doesn't exist. So if that's something that's sort of always yanking your ear and always bugging you that your time is not perfect, you got to get rid of that because things can be placed behind or slightly ahead of things, and they can still be incredibly musical and expressive. And when I say expressive, expression has to be part of the consideration for technique. Because, you know, I could play a scale, you know, at 160 with even eighth notes, but the fact is that I'm not going to sit in front of an audience and play a scale evenly at 160 for an audience. It's just not going to happen. It's not going to reveal anything about me. Mm-hmm. So when you sing, singing is a great way of sort of accessing expression. I'm not a great singer, but I use it all the time for my own personal practice. When you sing, and when you talk, like right now, when I said I got excited about something. My pitch went up. The speed at which the words came out quicker. There's all sorts of consonants that are happening. There's all sorts of music that's happening right now. There's all sorts of expression in my talking, and I'm not robotic, which is the equivalent of playing, you know, up and down picking, or right. If you're playing a bass, you know, I&M evenly. Technique is a way of playing things expressively. So some notes are loud, some are soft. It's never even. That's another thing. Not only is the placement not always exact, but the phrasing of notes is never exactly even. It's never that way.
No.
It just doesn't exist in nature.
You know, we did this Bobby Broom masterclass a while back, and, you know, Bobby was talking about time, and he said, people always ask me about my time. And he said, what it is just I have a very good internal time. So I always know where things are. George Coleman basically said the same thing. You know, he's like, I'm always kind of tapping my foot, but not necessarily. And he said, so if I play behind or I play ahead, like I always still know where the time is. And he said, it's just like when I played with Sonny, sometimes he would just go off and do this thing. And it wasn't eighth notes. It was just, they called it, I forget what he said, but he had a funny term for it. It was like Sunnyland or something, you know, I forget what it was. And he said that eventually it would just kind of skate across the time and the chords, but it's not as if he was lost or just, you know, free on an acid trip. I mean, you know, he was feeling the phrases in a different way. And you can do a lot if you know where the pulse is, right?
That's right.
And I know you march. I know that I've seen you march in practice like that too. And so you're always feeling it.
Yeah. And it's good to march just because it's a big motion in your body. Mm-hmm. Gets you out of your head. It's like dancing.
Totally.
I actually have a follow-up to what you just brought up, Adam, which is a great perception. You know, I've played with, I'm going to use Brian Blade as an example, because I played with Brian in a number of different situations. So I played with Brian in a really sort of, I would say, I have to use the right words, in a really formal sort of restricted way with Billy Childs. Mm-hmm. Billy's very specific compositionally. So I would play with Brian in those settings, and sometimes he would play something in terms of how he would phrase that would be, I don't know what the subdivision was. I don't know that there was a subdivision, you know, but I would really have to hold on to my center to steer myself through a certain path, mm-hmm. Just to find where one is or where the downbeat is. I'd really have to sort of ground myself. And I was struggling with it at first, but that was a situation that was sort of controlled because, you know, I was mainly playing notes that were written on the page, and I was sort of able to skate when I first played with Brian in that mm-hmm. setting. Scott Colley was playing bass, sure. Really taking care of biz. Then I played with Brian when I was subbing for Adam Rogers with John Patitucci.
Sure.
In a trio, right? Totally open, right?
Yeah.
The interesting thing was, okay, so I was open. I was kind of nervous about it. I was thinking, Jesus, is Brian going to like, am I going to be derailed by Brian's stuff? And Brian's a genius. I mean,
yeah, he's no doubt.
Totally brilliant, yeah. Right? And I hold him in such high esteem. And I played expressively in that group, and it was open, so I was being myself. And what I realized was he was just listening to me and supporting and just sort of feeling in the commentary. And if you kind of look at the phrase shape, exactly what you're saying, Adam, it's like a phrasing. It has nothing to do with – it's not linear time. It's not downbeat, next beat, next beat. It's fluid. It's rubber bandy, right?
Yeah, sometimes people think over four beats, right, or over eight. It's crazy.
That's right.
Yeah.
But when he played, it made total sense. Mm-hmm. And I felt very relaxed with it. It was amazing. It was like, okay, I get this. You just have to go with shape and phrase and quit trying to count each beat. It's beyond that.
Yeah, it's like, Jake, you did a lot of acid when you were a kid, right? So it's like you have to go with the trip no matter where it goes. Is that true?
I was more the guru in the group. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to, you know, resistance is not a good thing ever.
No, that's what I was
like, to anything. It's true, though. It works in every aspect of life.
Yeah, you have to let go.
But if you think about rhythm, like think about the most complicated cultures of rhythm, you know, music of India, like basically the Eastern world. That's all oral tradition.
Yeah.
So like that's how they were doing it anyway. It was phrases. It wasn't notation, you know. So it makes sense. I mean, especially with rhythm. Like that's
exactly right.
It's funny, Larry. I was thinking when you were talking about stopping playing and then realizing you love playing again. I went through a patch because I went to Manhattan School of Music when I was young, when I was 18, and I stopped going. I went for 1 year and I was gigging because I was a bassist and I was an electric bassist. So not only was it hard to be at that time, it was 93. Bob was there actually. So it was Mincer and, you know, some other guys. But it was more of a really straight ahead school. You know what I mean? Like there was no electric bassist. There was like me and like two other guys. And like you were pretty much demons, you know? So I was gigging and I was working and doing all that stuff. And basically 5 nights, 6 nights a week, some, you know, just whatever. And after a certain amount of time, I started writing music for television and I started getting good money from royalties and that stuff. And I was able to stop playing for a minute because by that time, and this is before I was 30, I was so burnt out from playing every night. And I don't know if this happens to everyone, but for me, I stopped enjoying playing and I was just doing it to pay rent. And when I took 1 year off and I was just writing music for television. And then when I moved to Los Angeles, I started playing bass again and I loved it. Like I needed a year to not play. And then I realized why I played in the first place. But I always told myself, if I ever stop liking this, like, why do it, you know? That's what I tell people. I'm like, if you're not 100% in this, then you can definitely find an easier job, you know?
Yeah.
You got to be committed to go down this path, right? I mean, and leading into the next question, so I'm not just ranting. I mean, you see a lot of kids. You teach at CalArts, right? You still there? Right.
Still.
I mean, you see a lot of kids, and what do you tell them to prepare them for this, and what do you see a lot of?
I think there's actually more opportunity. This is pre-lockdown. Mm-hmm. Especially if you know how to work with the internet and you're tech savvy, I think there are a lot of opportunities actually to get your music out there that didn't exist before. Now, along with that comes sort of a glut of product, right? It's like, and there's a lot of stuff out there that's not so great, and it's difficult to sort of weed yourself through all the stuff that's out there and find something that's a real jewel sometimes. Also, you know, there's been such a thrust towards education that a lot of people now are going to school to get degrees to become instructors for the next generation, right? So I kind of think that especially, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this since the lockdown. I think that education is sort of at an inflection point. First of all, a lot of schools are way too expensive. And, you know, who's going to pay these ridiculous fees when you have to learn remotely?
That's the big question. Schools are really hoping that there's a vaccine because the prices are crazy.
I mean,
what NYU is what, like 75 a year?
Is that right?
Dude, I think so. I think it's like 60 or 75 or something.
God.
Isn't that
is over 50,000.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically unsustainable.
Or and if you got loans, how do you pay it back, right?
Right.
I mean, whatever. So, anyway.
My advice to younger musicians, especially that want to come to CalArts, is to do, especially out of high school, when they come straight from high school. And then we do get applicants that come, that want to come to CalArts straight from high school that are ready. But I'll actually advise them to go to a junior college or some program that is not expensive so that they don't incur a lot of debt. You're exactly right, Adam. You know, you don't want to graduate with an arts degree with, you know, six figures of debt. You know, it's like a mortgage.
You also don't want to buy a plane and then realize you're afraid of heights. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, don't spend all the money. Right. You know, if you're not totally ready, because that is rare that kids are ready right out of high school. That's a talented person right there, you know, to really get something out of a school
you're
like
right.
that.
It's true. It's interesting also that among the younger generation, you know, when I was in high school and college, there really were no young artists that had huge contracts and had done really well and were already sort of known quantities. They're all older guys, right? And then, you know, Wynton Marsalis came along and you had the young lions, right? You had guys that had viable careers at a young age and were kind of on the map, right?
Yeah. It was actually a buzzword almost at that point. You know, the young lions was a big thing, you know. It was him and Mark Whitfield and Christian and those guys, you know.
That's right. And along with that came a perception by younger musicians that's what they're shooting for. And that stuff, of course, has all disappeared. There are no instrumental contracts for younger musicians, right? That's just not waiting for you with a record company. It's just not going to happen anymore, right? You know, a lot of younger musicians have the perception, in my generation, what I did after I graduated from college was I basically did anything I could do to keep working. So I played weddings, I played at parties, I did all sorts of horrible recordings that I didn't enjoy, but maybe I had the skills to sort of fake my way through some of this stuff. I played banjo. I'm a horrible banjo player. You know, I did it because there was the prospect of playing in a Dixieland band and making some money. I try to at least give students some information that they can take beyond just playing, you know, over, you know, I don't play standards when I play outside, but over
Let's
playing, you know,
Stella.
Playing over Donnelly or something like that, you know. So, you know, this is what you would, you know, learn your triads everywhere up and down the instrument so that when you have to play a banjo, you can play a decent solo on the top four strings, you know, with some triads. It's interesting because there's a generation that sort of doesn't realize that you have to cut. You know, John Scofield visited CalArts and some students asked him, you know, about his earlier days. And he talked about all his top 40 gigs, playing weddings. And, you know, John Scofield, iconic guy, you know, who's one of my heroes, you know. But he's from that generation where he was doing anything he could do to sort of put the pieces together.
So was Lee, man. I mean, like Dave told me that he had Catskill gigs, you know what I mean? Like all those guys, you know, they did all kinds of stuff.
That's right. You
know?
So,
there's
I mean,
no shame in
you
that.
Know, I guess that translates to in present times, you know, you have to be tech savvy. You have to, you know, right now I'm trying to get my home studio together. I'm right at the beginning. I've never done that before, but now I see it's a necessity.
I see the reel-to-reel behind you. It's really nice.
Thanks, Adam. Appreciate that, man. Cassette tapes.
Wait, it's a Tascam 4-track. It's just brand new. It's got that tag on it. No, I'm I'm with you. I mean, it's tough. It's a different era. And to be honest, everything has changed, right? Like, I can go and tell people that I would be mortified to be dating now. Like, as a young, I mean, in a, as a young person. Sorry, Jake.
I'm not young and I don't go on dates, so it's all good.
But, like, imagine.
Can't stop practicing, Jake. I know.
At a certain point, you know.
I'm at 90 BPM of saying, you know, my pickup lines are at 90 BPM right now. Those are just the quarter notes.
You can double that up, I think, if you just work on it. No, but, you know, imagine there being no mystery. Like, you know, you just know everything about social media and you can see what this other person's doing at all times. Like, you used to wonder what a girl was doing or what a guy was doing, right? And you had this whole thing in your head and you had no idea. And you'd call people and they just wouldn't be home. You know, there was, you know, they must be somewhere else, you know, and you'd have to find out where they were. So now everything is so different. But it's the same with music. Like, now with social media, if you didn't have a career already, you would have to modify what you were doing. You'd have to be really on social media. You'd have to be heavy on telling people where you were and that, so they know when you're back in town. It's not like you go out and you're like, hey, I'm back in town, you know. That you have to show people on Facebook that you're back in town or on Instagram and come up right. with creative things to do. It's a lot of work. And Jake and I have talked about this too. It's like, they just added another thing that musicians have to do in order to make money, right? Yeah, it's like, exactly. You know, it's like,
not to make money, to stay alive.
Yeah, to stay alive. No, it affects the younger generation more because as you get older and more established, you hopefully get some kind of tenured position or at least the respect and, you know, certain income for being who you are and your knowledge. But, you know, if you're 20 or even 30, it's different. It's tough, you know?
Totally different.
Yeah.
Do you know a guitarist named John Story by chance?
No.
I didn't know if John had done any
is he great?
Music masterclass videos. John is a graduate of USC for his undergraduate work, and he got his graduate degree at CalArts. And he has a group called New West Trio.
Oh, cool.
And I'm only bringing up John because he's, you know, much younger. I think he's in his early 30s. Mm-hmm. And he's basically created his career from the get-go, mm-hmm. right out of college. And, you know, he got really savvy at sort of booking gigs, putting tours together, working with social media. It's really amazing. And he's, you know, now he's at the point where other people are doing some of that stuff for him.
Right. Okay.
Obviously, you know, now that we're in lockdown, all that stuff's on hold. But he was, you know, touring Japan, touring mm-hmm. Europe, and it was a slow buildup. You know, of course, he was doing those van, tours. You know,
but you know, if you love really, it, you do it, and you're young, you can pull it off.
Exactly. You're young. You have the energy. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to sleep in a hotel room every night.
It's fun when you're young. It's an adventure.
I just bring him up as an example because he just kind of jumped in there, worked his ass off, mm-hmm. and learned all these different mediums that he had to. The reality was that he had to sort of master all these things in order to launch himself.
It's crazy. Some people are naturally good at that, though. We've talked about it somewhat on the program, but like Chad Lefkowitz Brown, he's an amazing social media guy. There's just certain people that are just amazing at getting these really creative and tantalizing things out there and getting noticed and having people want to check in and see what they're up to. It's, of course, Julian, you know, I mean, it doesn't hurt that he's amazing. But, you know, he always puts out very cool stuff and some people are just great at it. It's tricky. It's not natural for everyone. It's kind of like putting on scuba gear and breathing underwater. Like, you're not naturally supposed to breathe underwater. So you got to get used to it, you know.
But that's true. But, you know, someone like Julian, I think he's probably, you know, one of a handful of guys that has major management.
Yeah. You're right.
And deservedly so.
Yeah, he's bad, dude.
I mean, you know, Julian is a serious badass. You know, he's reinvented so much stuff on the instrument.
Yeah.
So, you know, he has that backing. You know, a lot of, you know, there's, you know, the vast majority of young musicians aren't going to get that kind of support.
No, you got that right. I got a cool thing here. This is a good one. And this is a good question. So one of our users, the same user that had the last question, had another question. So as we know, he's 45 and he's a nurse and he went to school and he didn't think he was ready for it and didn't get a lot out of it when he was at New England Conservatory. So he quit and just became a nurse. And now he's got a good job, steady income. He's got his head on right and he's ready to practice guitar. But one of his big problems now is that he's trying to incorporate music into his life at an older age. And he doesn't want to be like the old guy blowing chunks at a jam session, in his words. And, you know, my first thought about this was, you know, first of all, no one wants to be the guy blowing chunks at a jam session. And that oftentimes people that are full-time motivated, like they want to be full-time, like that even weighs heavier on you. Because I remember when I would fuck up somewhere, I would just have nightmares about it and think my career was over, you know? So, I mean, I think that it always is hard for anyone to be in those situations. And also, you know, first of all, we need nurses right now. And second of all, there's no shame in having a real job. I don't know. What do you think? How does he, you know, get over that and integrate music in his normal life at this point?
You know, most people are drawn to music because they're interested in artists that, you know, especially in the jazz realm, that are really not famous people and never made a lot of money, mm-hmm. right? It's just not a money-making proposition at its core.
Right.
It's not. But there is a purity, and there is something that really, you know, for myself, speaking from my own perspective, that draws me to it in a really pure way. I love it, right? So I think a lot about the social aspect of music. I think it's important to sort of just connect with one person that you connect with. Almost everybody has that, either from their past or from being in circumstances later on in life, someone that they connect with musically, someone that connects the dots for them. Someone that puts them at ease, someone that sort of feels like they can sort of complete their sentences, you know, or supports them. I have a handful of guys like that. I have about five guys on the planet, and that's not to say that they're greatest musicians on the planet. They're just the guys that make, that facilitate this ability for me to play. Actually, the first guy that really did that for me was Charlie Hayden. I did a duo gig with Charlie Hayden, and it was...
I thought you said these guys weren't the best musicians, and then just land with Charlie Hayden.
Not necessarily the best. Not all five of them. I won't name
Charlie's
all of them.
A bad dude, man. And a legend.
Charlie was amazing. But the perspective that Charlie played from was total support all right. the time. His pitch was incredible.
Yeah.
You know, it's just center, right in the center. His musical choices were beautiful and streamlined and always minimal. So you had all this open space. And when you played with him, it was like being in an elevator shaft. You just like the bottom falls out and something happens that just like makes, this is a horrible thing. It kind of feels like vomiting. It's like all this shit's coming out of you.
Yeah.
And it's... You know, that's the only thing I can think. It feels like actually your guts are just sort of wrenching.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, man.
And when you find that, and I do have some other musicians that had that have that same effect on me, that's something that's like gold. You have to hang on to that. And I check in with those situations all the time. I know I don't play jam sessions anymore. Jam sessions have no appeal to me whatsoever. Because usually it's about, you know, proving something. And I don't want to prove, I'm old now. I don't want to prove something. You know, I have no need to prove something.
You don't want to make a Spike coffee shop next to next to Mocha Joe?
I think most people will get that reference.
If they don't, they should look it up. Yeah. No, but I also think that one other thing that we kind of touched on earlier, and that I felt strongly about in this user or this man's story, is that when I got out of high school, I literally thought that music had chosen me, and that, and it, I've said this before, but it's hard to verbalize it. I really didn't think I had another option. Although my grades were good and I could have done something else, I felt that if I didn't do music, I was going to regret it for the rest of my life. And maybe that's just my severe OCD or something, but I don't feel like I had a choice. And to be honest, I feel like if you don't have that, if you think you have a choice and you're on the fence, then maybe you shouldn't do it full time right away, because you don't want to have that kind of relationship with music where you feel as though it may have ruined your life. You know, oh, I could have done all this shit and now I'm whatever age and I don't have any other skills. And, you know, like, I would hate to do that, but I knew I never had a choice. So that was a wash. I never blamed music for anything. I said, this is what I'm doing. Hopefully I do something within it. And I was okay and, you know, successful. And, but yeah, I worked hard and all that. But I feel as though if you shouldn't ever regret making that decision to have a straight job or anything, because if you weren't feeling it, don't do it.
I absolutely agree. I mean, there's so many, you know, Denny Zeitlin was a psychologist. He got his PhD, you know, and became a clinical psychologist. I think he still is to this day.
Oh, wow.
And he always had a double career.
Dr. Eddie Henderson.
That's right. Eddie Henderson, same situation. Yeah. I had a student named Hide Tokunaga, a guitarist from Japan, who actually lived in New York for 5 years. Yeah. And he loves the music. I mean, he's a very genuine guy, loves the music, comes from the right place, but kind of realized early on that he had a family too. He married a lady, American lady, and had a child, that it wasn't going to work for him to just play guitar. So he was a computer programmer, mm-hmm. and he always had that side job. And to this day, and Hide is probably, you know, maybe in his 40s now. Mm-hmm. He's still, you know, active as a player.
Yeah. And he probably loves it. You know, he's probably so psyched to get out and play, man.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because I'm sure that you've seen this too, right? Well, when I was coming up in New York, I mean, I saw a lot of guys and, you know, men and women, of course, that were burnt, you know, and by 40 even, you know, and I always thought, I don't want to be the crusty guy, you know, because especially at school, you see the certain teachers that are just a little too crusty, you know, and they can play, but they just feel slighted or whatever. It's a mental thing, and they feel they have to teach, and that was always the hard thing. It's not whiplash, you know, but it's, they don't want to be there, you know, and you don't want to be that person, you know, you don't want to do that. And I feel that if you ever stop loving what you're doing, you don't have to quit, but you have to rethink it and at least do what you did and put your axe down and figure it out, right? I mean, take a breath, go on a hike, maybe take a sabbatical, you know?
Man, Adam, you put it so beautifully, and I relate to all this stuff you're talking about. I would see, you know, musicians that were people that I looked up to, some of which, as human beings, I did not want to end up being like. There were so many instances of that. And in my mind, and I'm kind of like you, I mean, I felt like I had no choice. I had to do this. I had to pursue this. But in my mind, there was no way I wanted to end up like them, you know. Just these shells of human beings as they grew older.
And pissed off, yeah, all the time, right?
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be that way.
No, it doesn't have to be that way. And I think that there's something to having another job to that you don't have to take those gigs that you don't want to take just to make your rent. So I think it's a nice thing, you know, I mean, and to me, it's more than a nice thing. Like for this guy, if we're continuing to talk about him, not only can you continue your love of music and just do what you want to do because you have steady income, but you also have the freedom to, if you want to get into the scene and start making money, You also have the option of booking your own gigs and paying good cats to play with you. So if you want to book a local gig, you might be able to hire some pretty good players to play with you. And then if you play well, you can get on their radar, you know? I mean, and that's something that you can do if you have a real job, you know?
Absolutely.
Or a trust fund, but, you know, I didn't have one of those.
You can hire the, you know, the not-so-good players like Charlie Hayden.
Marvin Smitty Smith.
Those cats, whoever, yeah. You know.
Jack DeJohnette, all these slouches. Yeah.
Yeah, Jack's probably ready to do some gigs by now. I bet his prices come way down.
Roy Haynes. All right, there you go.
Roy Haynes, who's 95. I just, yeah. You know.
Man.
Smitty was just telling me that he's 95. I couldn't believe it.
You know? Doesn't sound 95.
Oh my God. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I filmed George Coleman a while back, and you know, it's great to get these, and Lewis Hayes, you know. I had these back to back, just got masters telling me these amazing stories. And of course I was trying to get instructional content for the site, but all I really wanted to hear were the stories, you know. I just wanted to,
some good ones.
Yeah, I was just letting them go, and George was just going great, you know. George is great. The one of them that I've told to other people, and it's on his masterclass. I'll send it to you just because it's so much fun to listen to. He talks about, he's like, he came, the reason people ask him why he can play in so many keys, and he's like, you know,
piano thing.
Yeah, and he's like, well, he's like, when I was from the South, and what you had to do, we called it cross. You had to cross because the piano would be so out of tune that you couldn't even tune to it. You just have to just play it in another key, you know? And he's like, the pianos were so bad down South that, you know, you get there and there'd be strings missing and it'd just be a mess. And he said, one time my pianist, he was so pissed off that we kept playing the same place on the road. And the piano was so messed up, they never fixed it. He ripped all the strings out. So nothing, he said, now nothing's going to work. And they're going to have to fix this thing. So they come back like 6 months later on the road. And he goes to play a note, just like, you know, like nothing works. Like nothing works. He goes, well, he says, hey, man, when did you get this thing tuned last? And the owner said, I just got a fresh coat of paint on it the other day. But it's like, you know, it's just genius old shit, you know. That
lovely stories.
Yeah, those stories are amazing, man. But, man, Larry, you're the best. And I'm slightly brain dead because my child wakes up at 6 a.m. And I think we've had a great chat here. And I thank you so much for coming on.
Well, Adam, total pleasure. I'm a big fan of yours. And so great talking with you and Jake, because you both are kind of coming from the same place. And, you know, there's all sorts of analogs that you can see. When I see what you've created with My Music Masterclass, there's totally your love at its core.
Thanks, man.
And how it's sort of, I know you've worked your ass off to pull it off, but at its core, it's very organic, the way it's sort of grown. And man, kudos.
Thank you very much. And for those of you who don't know, Larry has some amazing and very popular videos on the site, and he's just such a great natural teacher because he's a giving person. You could feel it. You can feel it in the videos, and it's like meditative to watch Larry, you know. I feel as your lessons come through this very straight and relaxing way. It's like watching Bob Ross paint.
I love it. That's exactly what I'm going for. Bob
the,
Ross.
The Bob Ross of the guitar. Larry,
I'm gonna wear like a little fro on the next video.
Man, if I didn't have a hat on right now, you all can't see me because we're on video, but you know, it's quarantine time in here and my hair's getting a little bit big. So anyway,
thanks,
I think
Adam. Thanks, Jake.
That's it for
good
now.
See
you soon.
Bye bye.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail? You can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So look forward to hearing from you.